From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Mark Report. It is the 11th day of May 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities. He's in Newmarket, Indiana. And then Stephen Platt of Archer Financial Services will join us to take up the ag energy markets. In the second half hour of our program on many of these stations and always online at willag.org, we'll talk with the chair of the House Agriculture Committee, Colin Peterson. We recorded that one this morning. He's fresh off a field hearing swing out west looking to get ideas for the 2012 Farm Bill. You'll definitely want to stay tuned if you can. Along the way, as always on a Tuesday during the growing season, we'll hear about crop progress from the five top corn-producing states in the nation. And don't forget, in just 26 minutes, meteorologist Don Day will be here to take a look at the agricultural weather forecast on this Tuesday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
In Chicago on this Tuesday afternoon, futures finished the day like this. The nearby May wheat, well, I don't have a settlement price, although I do, 482.5, up a penny and a quarter for the afternoon. And then in the July contract, the settlement price at 509.5, up a penny and a half. That May actually at 502.5, up a penny and a half. September futures, 521.25, up 1.5. And then July futures, 493.25, a half cent in Chicago higher for the soft red. Now the May corn futures, 369.75, the settlement price up 6.75. July at 377, 6.5 cents higher. September at 384, up 6.25. And December futures at 393, up 6.5 cents. The March futures at 405.25, up 6. May beans at 958.25, up 5.5 cents. July at 966, a nickel higher. August soybeans, 962.5, up 4.75. September at 946, 3.25 higher. And November bean futures, 937.5, up 2.75. May contract in the bean meal at 282.30, up $4.10. July at 281.60, up 290. May oil, 38.03, 7 cents lower. July down 7 as well, 38.32. June live cattle futures, a 96.80 settlement price, a dime higher. The August contract there up 30 cents at 95.37.5. May feeders at 112.10, down 52.5 cents. The August contract at 115.60, down 32.5. And the May lean hogs today, 87.92.5, down 67.5 cents. The June contract at 85.32.5, down 52.5. Recapping the wheat futures, July hard red at 509.5, a penny and a half higher. July soft red at 493.25, up a half. You are listening to the Closing Market Report. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil futures, June contract, $76.23 a barrel, now down 57 cents. June ethanol at $1.63.8. That's up a penny and a tenth for the day. And the natural gas at 4.14 7/10 of a cent. That's $4.14 7/10. Down 2 3/10 cents. Heating oil or diesel fuel at $2.13 7/10. Up a penny and 6/10. And the gold futures today at $1,219.90 an ounce, up $19.50. The Dow Jones Industrial Average at 10,797, just about 13 points higher. And the Goldman Sachs for the afternoon at 515.94 is up 1.12 on the afternoon. Here's what the weather forecast looks like from our own Mike Sola. He says for this evening, should be mostly cloudy across the two-state regions, some showers and thunderstorms. Lows will range from 45 in northeastern Indiana to 60 in the south. And then tomorrow in Illinois, mostly cloudy, showers, mainly before noon. In Indiana, cloudy, scattered showers and thunderstorms. Highs tomorrow will range from 52 in far northwestern Illinois to 82 in far southern Illinois. Showers and thunderstorms will continue to recharge topsoil moisture throughout the two-state area. That before several dry days develop Friday through the weekend. Some rainfall totals may reach up to 5 inches, says Mr. Sola, in isolated areas, leading, of course, to localized flooding, causing some extended delays in planting of soybeans. The areas most likely to see the flooding will be in the south and separately in northern Indiana. Temperatures will trend slightly below average in northwestern and western Illinois and slightly above in the eastern and southern parts of Indiana through the middle of next week. More on the agricultural weather when we get to the bottom of the hour and we talk with meteorologist Don Day.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report from Illinois Public Media. It's a Tuesday afternoon, time to check in on the agricultural futures markets and what happened in Chicago after the USDA reports were released this morning. Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities in New Market, Indiana, joins us today. Good afternoon to you, Wayne.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Well, let's start with the numbers that came out from USDA and the WASD numbers. Corn was lowered. They are now at 1.738 billion bushels, actually. And that's down from the April estimate of a 1.899 billion bushel carryover. Beans were left the same at 190 million bushels. And then, of course, they took their first stab at next year, and they say that maybe there's a 13.1 billion bushel crop out there. That compares, of course, to the 12.1 billion bushel in 2008. That's, of course, for the 2009 corn production. I'm sorry. And they did lower that just slightly. They adjusted that one from last fall to 13.1 from 13.13 because of standing corn that didn't get harvested, I suppose, in South and North Dakota. But it didn't seem to have too much of an impact in Chicago, did it?
Well, of course, you know, we dropped the 21 million bushels for field loss in North and South Dakota. And, of course, we also increased the corn for ethanol. We bumped it up 100 million for next year, and then with the exports for the 50 million also, Todd. But the feed and residual was cut to 75 million. So, you know, it was sort of a give and take, Robin, Peter, paying Paul, and doing a little bit that way to get us done even. But it still left us with some pretty hefty numbers, but, you know, some favorable things by increasing the exports. There's still the thought that there could be some Chinese business that takes place. Just, you know, some increased exports on the corn, Todd. And that was what gave us sort of a friendly call. And the call early this morning was just a 2 to 3 higher in the corn. And that, you know, we doubled that by the time the day was over. But, you know, we looked at the early call on the beans because there was nothing really friendly about it. That was 5 to 9 lower, and here we are 4 to 5 higher. So it was a positive day before it was all over.
Hey, did you catch the paragraph in the WASD that talked about the changes they made going back to 97 and 98?
You know, read a little bit about it, and it was going back. They said to adjust some of the things that they were adjusting for this last report. They felt they need to do more than 1 year and go back and do a few things and wanted to make it more credible by doing some of that.
Yeah, so they adjusted some things based on corn sweetener usage and some other data that they were able to collect, but it had to do with the feed and residual. The paragraph noted that it didn't really make much difference in previous years, but that this year it did change things just a bit, and those showed up in the numbers that we just gave to our producers and listeners at this point. So here we are. Well, you have something to say.
Well, I was just going to say, I think that it comes into effect more this the last couple of years because of the DDGs,
right,
being much more, you know, when we talk about feed and residual of what's left after processing, you know, in the past, we didn't have near as much of our corn crop going into byproducts to be resold and back into some of the feed market. And, of course, China hasn't been importing that much corn of ours, but, yes, they have been big in the DDG market.
Indeed. And so that was one of the other things that I think that they were trying to capture, but they still don't have a good way to catch all that data. They're working on it.
It's a work in progress. There you go.
Indeed. So what does it all mean to the producer that's sitting on the farm this afternoon and looking at the numbers and saying, well, now what?
I think that, unfortunately, it comes back to we saw gold today right now has even increased even more as we went on, and basically all-time highs in gold up $30, which is telling us that there's still some flight to quality, that because of that, there's a feeling that the funds are going to possibly want to own some commodities, and because of that, more so than the actual supply-demand numbers we looked at here, because they weren't that impressive. I mean, basically, long-term, if you look at fundamentals, we're going to have plenty of corn, plenty of beans, but the outside markets, being the gold, the crude oil, and things like that, are telling us that we are in a little bit of an inflationary attitude towards the commodities.
And so if we're in the inflationary attitude, does it behoove farmers to hang on?
I would say that we've got to give it a chance to see if it'll follow through a little bit. We are, as we talked on Commodity Week, you know, around the $4 East corn, we're still thinking that that is going to stifle rallies a lot. We do know that, of course, some charts point to 423. We're not going to be say that we'll look right past that and say that it can't go there, but we will say that fundamentally anything above $4 looks like a better sell and buy to us.
On soybeans?
On the soybeans, you know, and basically as we look back, you know, we're at 937. We got to close them above that 945 that was resistance for a long time and work our way back on up. But basically the July beans, there's a lot of people talking or thinking that, you know, that they can go another 20, 30 cents just because of money flow, not necessarily because of the bean supply or the supply-demand. You know, we've got tremendous amount of beans in South America that are booked up, ready to ship, and cheaper than ours. And the way that the crop's going in the ground and the way the carryout looked coming into this, you know, there's not a fundamental reason to go there. But technically and money-wise, why we can see a little bit of a run up here.
We do appreciate you taking the time with us.
Thank you, Todd.
Wayne Nelson is with L&M Commodities in New Market, Indiana. He joins us here on the Closing Mark Report. That happens each and every Tuesday afternoon. A bit later in the program, in the second half hour, in fact, on some of these radio stations and online, of course, at willag.org. That's willag.org. We'll talk with the chairman of the House Agriculture Committee. That's Colin Peterson, a congressman from Minnesota. Had that discussion this morning. If you can listen to it, please do, either on the radio station or at willag.org.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. Well, USDA yesterday afternoon released its latest crop progress report. It showed by May the 9th, corn producers had planted 81% of the intended 2010 crop acreage. That was well ahead of last year and the five-year average, and the third quickest pace on record behind the 2004 and 2000 crop years, respectively. Despite rainfall limiting field work in some areas, the rapid planting pace continued across much of the major corn-producing region. Throughout the Corn Belt, overall planting progress remained 20 percentage points or more ahead of normal. Conversely, planting was slow in areas of Kentucky and Tennessee, that following the heavy rainfall and flooding that left producers contending with standing water and debris-littered fields. Soybeans, nationally, 30% of this year's soybean crop planted by the 9th day of May, 17 percentage points ahead of last year, 11 points ahead of the five-year rolling average. And despite below-average temps, rainfall last week, producers in Illinois, Iowa, and Minnesota, the three largest soybean-producing states, planted 21% or more of their crop during the week. Overall, emergence reached 7% complete by the week's end, 4 percentage points ahead of last year, and 3 percentage points ahead of the five-year average. Winter wheat now, heading to the winter wheat crop, advanced 13 points during the week to 40% complete by the 9th day of May, slightly ahead of last year, 3 points ahead of the five-year average. 66% of the winter wheat crop was reported in good to excellent condition. Now here are the state statisticians from Illinois, Iowa, Nebraska, Minnesota, and Indiana.
This is Brad Parks, Deputy Director from USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, Iowa Field Office, with the weekly Crops and Weather Report for the week ending May 9th, 2010. The past week saw scattered rain showers, high winds, colder temperatures, and widespread frost. Temperatures dropping into the high 20s in northern Iowa and low 30s in southern Iowa during the overnight hours led to frost and decreasing soil temperatures. This caused concern that replanting may be necessary. Lower temperatures also caused emergence of newly planted crops to slow. Corn acreage planted was 93% complete, increasing 9 percentage points from last week. Corn planting progress is 11 days ahead of last year and the 5-year average. Corn acreage emerged was 48%, well ahead of the 21% last year and the 5-year average of 17%. Soybean acreage planted was 44% complete, compared with 19% last year and 17% for the 5-year average. Early planted soybeans have begun to emerge. Again, this has been Brad Parks, Deputy Director from USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, Iowa Field Office, with the weekly crops and weather report for the week ending May 9th, 2010.
This is Brad Schwab, Chief Crop Statistician with the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, Illinois Field Office, reporting on crop progress and conditions for the week ending May 9th. Farmers across much of Illinois were enjoying another week of favorable weather conditions, allowing most to finish corn planting and to get a good start on seeding beans. Statewide, corn planting advanced to 94% complete. This is well ahead of last year's 9% and the five-year average of 65%. Emergence advanced to 63% compared to 3% emerged last year and 33% for the five-year average. The area of the state leading in corn emergence was the Central Crop Reporting District at 83%, while the Northeastern Crop Reporting District trailed all others at 42%. Soybean planting made good progress last week and now stands at 33% complete compared to 0% planted last year and 18% for the five-year average. The Eastern Crop Reporting District leads the state with 50% of their soybeans in the ground. 4% of soybeans have emerged compared to 1% for the five-year average. The soft red winter wheat crop was reported at 43% headed, and this compares to 19% last year and 40% for the five-year average. The condition of the wheat crop was rated 4% very poor, 25% poor, 38% fair, 31% good, and only 2% excellent. This has been Brad Schwab with the Illinois Field Office of the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service in Springfield.
This is David Biar of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service with the crop weather report for the week ending May 9th, 2010. Corn planted was 78% complete, ahead of last year's 74% and 65% average. Corn emerged was 16%. Soybean planting progressed to 26% complete, which was the same as last year, but ahead of the 15% average. Sorghum planting was 8% complete, ahead of last year and average. Wheat conditions rated 5% poor, 25% fair, 62% good, and 8% excellent, below the 74% good or excellent of last year. Wheat jointed is 55%. Alfalfa conditions were mostly good or excellent and well above last year. First cuttings of alfalfa have begun. This is David Biar of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service, Nebraska Field Office in Lincoln.
Hello, this is Greg Preston, Director of the USDA NAS Field Office for Indiana, and this is the crop weather report for the week ending May 9th. A second week of rains and wet fields slowed the record pace of corn planting. Despite cool temperatures, the corn and soybean emergence and plant population are good in most areas of the state. Continued windy weather limited herbicide application for the week. Southern Indiana had areas that reported some flooding in low-lying areas which may require replanting of the field crops. 81% of the intended corn acreage has been planted, ahead of last year's 10% planted at this time and the five-year average of 52%. By area of the state, 81% had been planted in the north, 88% had been planted in the central region, and 66% in southern Indiana. 52% of the planted corn acreage has emerged, well ahead of the 2% recorded for last year and the 17% for the five-year average. 35% of the intended soybean acreage has been planted, compared to 2% for last year and 19% for the five-year average. 9% of the planted soybean acreage has emerged, well ahead of the 0% recorded for last year and the 1% for the five-year average. 91% of the winter wheat acreage is jointed compared to 79% for last year and 86% for the five-year average. 14% of the winter wheat acreage is headed compared to 13% last year and 18% for the average. Winter wheat condition is rated at 73% good to excellent compared to 79% last year at this time. This is Greg Preston reporting from the Indiana NAS Field Office.
And I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. You're listening to Illinois Public Media. This is the Closing Market Report. It is a Tuesday afternoon. Time to check the agricultural cash grain, actually the agricultural energy markets on the line with us today. To help us do that, Stephen Platt of Archer Financial Services. It's an ADM subsidiary. Good afternoon to you, Stephen. How are you?
Good afternoon, Todd.
Well, last week as we were having our discussion on ag energies, I got an email and a phone call both from a listener in Indiana, wanted to know what, if any, impact the need to finance the national debt might have on the price of crude oil. And he wanted to build principal and interest into that. I don't know whether that's a good or a fair question or not, but I suppose you could take it up in some form.
Well, one of the ways of paying back a growing deficit is by reflation. That would affect all commodities, and it certainly crude would be one of those that would be included, Don.
So we're at about $76 a barrel in crude. How much of that, maybe in a percentage, would you think would be reflation then?
Well, you know, I think it's a combination of things. I don't think the government's pushing prices higher, but there are a combination of factors which are encouraging it. Certainly low interest rates in terms of short-term rates is encouraging speculative buying of the energy markets. And that has, I think, somewhat inflated prices to a degree here.
Once the government were to start to raise interest rates, if that were to happen, and they say it won't for a while, how much might we lose in crude oil?
Well, I think it will depend on what you lose in terms of economic activity. If, in fact, economic activity continues to grow at the same time that interest rates rise, you would actually be able to support prices, and it would also probably have some impact by way of the dollar in terms of actually offsetting some of those increases.
Let's turn our attention to the agricultural energy markets themselves. Ethanol producers doing well at this point?
Well, to some extent they are. They're I think the mandate here in terms of the demand side certainly has will help the producer down the road. USDA did increase their ethanol forecast by about 200 million bushels for next year, which I think is a supportive influence.
And then turn your attention to something that happened last week, and maybe you can help explain this, because I'm certain it's been done a couple of times, that 1,000-point drop in the Dow. How does that happen when, and we've seen it happen at the Chicago Board of Trade or the CME Group a couple of times, but what happens that makes it drop so quickly when a mistake is made?
Well, I think there's still a lot of questions on what the mistake was. But overall, you have so much linkage between the ETFs, individual stocks, cash stocks, arbitrage, all those factors combined work on the market. And at that particular point in time, there was a lot of attention and a lot of pulling back, I guess, in terms of fresh buying into these markets because of the Greek riots. And so that made for rather thin conditions. And once those selling programs started to evolve, it kind of cascaded.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Sure enough.
That's Stephen Platt. He's with Archer Financial Services. That's an ADM subsidiary based in Chicago, Illinois. In just a couple of minutes, I'll return when we'll talk with Don Day of Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming. You are, of course, listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. You can always hear us online if you'd like at willag.org. That's willag.org.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Bob Baisdefer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Here's something of interest from the University of Illinois. Using a wet ethanol production method that begins by soaking corn kernels rather than grinding them results in more gallons of ethanol and more usable co-products, giving ethanol producers a bigger bang for their buck by about 20%. Agricultural engineer Isha Kuller says that the conventional ethanol production method has fewer steps, but other than distiller's dried grains with soluble, it doesn't have any other co-products. But in both wet and dry fractionation processes, the result is ethanol, distiller's dried grains with soluble, as well as germ and fiber. In comparing the wet and dry fractionation methods, Kuller's research team found that when using the wet fractionation method, the result is even higher ethanol concentrations coming out of the fermenter and better quality co-products than the dry method. The process doesn't require developing any new equipment. Kuller says it's just a modification of things that are already being done in the corn processing industry, and that's something of interest from the University of Illinois.
Something of Interest is a public service of the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences at the University of Illinois.
Support for WILL comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks by developing dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is at stuart-peterson.com.
You're listening to the Closing Mark Report from Illinois Public Media. It is a Tuesday afternoon. Don Day of Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming, is now on the line to talk about the agricultural weather forecast. Don, we heard earlier in the week that it was going to rain and then rain again and rain some more after that. Does it still look the same?
Well, it does. We've got at least one more period where it's going to be getting cool and wet across many areas of the Midwest. We've got another system that's coming in out of the Rockies and the High Plains, much like the last couple of systems have done. Now, I think that this system coming through, once it moves on through, we're probably going to find ourselves in a pattern that's going to be a little warmer and maybe not so frequently wet. Certainly this time of year, you expect some wet periods, but I think the spacing between storms will get a little bit longer, a little more distance, a little more time between them.
Yeah, that sounds good probably to producers, because what you said there was that it wasn't going to just shut off, that the spacing between storms would still be there. How long do you think that spacing will be? What kind of time frame?
Well, I would say that instead of systems coming through about every 3 days, we're going to probably stretch that to 4 to 6 days. So that's going to help in terms of drying out things a little bit. And at the same time, also getting a weather pattern that is going to get a little bit warmer. I still think that we've got a week before we sort of get into that weather pattern. Until then, we are still going to be averaging some cooler temperatures and what will be some shower and thunderstorm activity. The system that's coming in out of the Plain States and Rockies will bring a period of coolness our way as we get into Friday and the weekend.
And tell me about that current system that's coming through the Midwest at this point. How much rainfall with it? Who gets it and where?
It's going to favor the northern and western areas. We could see rainfall amounts that could be anywhere from 2 to 3 inches or more. This is going to be especially true in central northern Illinois, central and eastern Iowa, Missouri, eastern Kansas, stretching up into southern Wisconsin, all of Michigan, all of Ohio, and all of northern and central Indiana. So it's going to be a good soaker for those areas. Now, amounts of rain will be less, but will still be pretty impressive over the southern Corn Belt, into the southern areas of the plains, into the upper Mississippi areas. Those areas looking at probably about 1 to 2.5 inches of rain.
I did not catch at that point. Did you suggest Ohio would be getting rainfall in this process too, or very much of it?
They should, in a short term. The system that's going to be moving in here shortly is going to be a good rain producer for Ohio.
Yeah, and I suppose my bigger worry there was the Ohio River and floods downstream. They're already soaked with that big rain.
Yeah, and that is a concern. There's no doubt about it. There could be enough rain in those drainages to send some water downstream. The good news is it's a fairly progressive system, and we're hoping that keeps the amounts down somewhat.
Turn your attention to China. They've had a slow start to their season. What can they expect over the coming week?
Well, as we head into and go over to East Asia and take a look at China, it looks like at least in the short term, there's going to be some pretty good chances of some wet weather. This is going to favor the eastern and central and southern growing areas of China, not so much moisture out west. But it's an active pattern. At least for the next week or two, China's got a couple of storm systems that will bring frequent chances of precipitation and keep temperatures at or a little below normal.
Yeah, and finally, since you're out there in Wyoming, how are the skies there today?
gray and winter storm warnings abound. In fact, you'll probably hear on news reports, places like Denver, Cheyenne, Wyoming, those areas looking at a late spring snow that could be a half a foot to a foot.
Get out the shovel, buddy.
There you go.
All right. Thanks much, Don.
Thank you.
Don Day is with Day Weather out of Cheyenne, Wyoming. He joins us here on the Closing Market Report on a Tuesday afternoon. We'll say goodbye to some of our radio stations now. For the rest of you, stay with us, because on the Farming World this afternoon, we'll talk with the chair of the House Ag Committee, Representative Colin Peterson from Minnesota. This is the Farming World news and interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today, we'll talk with Minnesota's 7th District Congressman, Colin Peterson. Mr. Peterson is the chair of the House Agriculture Committee and has just returned from a series of Farm Bill field hearings. That legislation, of course, to be updated in 2012. Mr. Peterson, thank you so very much for taking your valuable time to have this discussion with us today. We do really appreciate it.
Well, I'm glad to be with you.
Let's begin with something that I'd like to ask, and hopefully you'll be able to talk to us just a little bit about. I'd like to know something about your background as a child more than anything else. You grew up on a farm in Baker, Minnesota,
right?
Though you were born in Fargo, North Dakota. How did you move to Minnesota, and what kind of farm were you on?
Well, we didn't move any place. Our farm was 13 miles from Fargo-Moorhead, and the only hospital in the area was Fargo. And so if I wouldn't have been born in Fargo, I'd have been born out on the farm.
I see. So tell me about the farm.
Well, we had a section of land, and we raised just about every kind of crop, corn, soybeans, wheat, durum wheat, barley, oats, sunflowers, potatoes, raised a lot of potatoes. We had... We fed out Holstein steers every year, quite a few. We had hogs. We had sheep. We had about everything, except we didn't have any dairy. So I got to do it all. I did most of the farm work from the time I was about 10, 11 years old. So I have a hands-on experience with about everything that you can do on the farm.
Do you still have the section? The family, that is?
You know, my dad is just turned 90, and he decided he's been renting it out for the last number of years, and one guy has rented it for quite a while. So he sold everything but one quarter. So he decided it's time to simplify his life.
Well, indeed, at 90, probably time. My father's 84, and he's probably thinking about the same thing. But thank you for indulging me that.
No problem.
I do like to know sometimes where our congressmen come from and what their background is, as we talk about it.
After college, I became a CPA, and I did most of my work was with farmers.
Yeah, I saw that you went to college for accountancy at Morehead State?
Right.
Mm-hmm. All right. So now you're the chair of the Agriculture Committee for the House, and you just returned from field hearings. You were in Iowa, Idaho, California, and Wyoming. What did they tell you in those varying states?
Well, it depends on who they were, but by and large, they're relatively happy with the current farm bill. You know, there are significant issues in dairy. Their industry is trying to pull together with some kind of new policy in dairy to try to eliminate some of this extreme volatility that we've been having and this big problem we had last year that really, we're not out of yet, and it's cost farmers a lot of equity, and it just the system is seems to need an overhaul. So they're looking at things. We heard about crop insurance, but you know the farm economy, with the exception of dairy and hogs, has been one of the bright spots as we've gone through this economic downturn, and I think that shows that the farm bill is working pretty well. But we're going to be up against significant budget issues when we get to the next farm bill. I think everybody kind of recognizes that, and I just thought it would make sense to get out and start listening to people early, and also encouraging people to take a look at what we're currently doing and look at the money that we're currently spending and tell us if they think that the system that we have is the right system, or whether, given the money that we're spending, it could be done a better way. And there are some efforts going on, and I think all of the commodity groups to take a look at what we're doing and give us input over the next year about how we could improve things if as we move forward.
I'm wondering if they talk to you much about the CWT program, which is the private program that the dairy producers can participate in from time to time and has been buying out whole herds over the last several years and culling herds. What do they think of that program? Do they think that USDA, that the government should get involved more thoroughly in a program like that, or do they have other ideas?
Well, we didn't hear much about the CWT. You know, that program, I think, helped during this downturn. It probably helped us to get back to, somewhat close to break even now, a little quicker. But I think the industry is taking a look at this and decided they don't want the government to run this. They're not sure that if it's a government-run program that it's going to be successful. And they're looking at other ideas to try to keep the production, the demand and supply and in balance. I think the CWT program going forward is probably, from what I hear, is going to end this year, if it hasn't already. There's been too many free riders in it, and that they just about didn't get the support the last time within the industry. I think they need to have, under their bylaws or something, they need to have 2/3 or 70% participation in order for that to go forward. But I think they're looking at some other ideas, some of which were discussed a little bit in the hearings. But there's an effort going on behind the scenes within National Milk and all the dairy groups trying to come to terms with how they want to move forward.
Yeah, maybe we can make a transition here with them, because the CWT, one of the things that they were willing to do was to purchase and then, for all intents and purposes, dump, I suppose, milk onto the international market. And in the governmental realms, that's not quite the same type of program, but we call it GSM 102. Mm-hmm. And I was hoping you might be able to talk to me a little bit about the export credit program as it relates to all the commodities. In particular, cotton's come under fire from Brazil, and there has been a WTO assessment against the U.S. United States, and we're now paying some $147 million annually to Brazil for the GSM 102 program and other things. Export credit program, what will happen with it?
Well, I think it's too early to say. Obviously, we're going to have to take a look at what we're doing, given the outcome of the Brazil case. But I don't think anybody has come to any conclusion at this point about what the answer is. The cotton industry has been starting to meet. They've been meeting now to talk about what the response is going to be, which we are hoping to be able to deal with in the farm bill and not have to deal with it prior to that. That's what the administration negotiated with Brazil, although there's a 60-day period here where there's some discussions going on that I guess could possibly change that. But we're hoping that it gives us the time to take a look at how we restructure the cotton situation. And given the way the WTO ruled, we're going to have to look at these GSM programs as well. But there hasn't, I don't think at this point, there's any clear direction about what where we're going or how that's going to be handled.
What do you think the budget itself impact might be on the 2012 Farm Bill update?
Well, I don't think there's any outcome that's going to be anything but difficult. But I think it's too early. Here again, it's too early to really tell. We've got the baseline projection for right now, but what the baseline will be in, when we head into marking up the 2012 bill. We're not exactly sure. And, you know, what happens with this debt commission that was set up by President Obama, and what they come out with in December, whether there's going to be an attempt to do some kind of reconciliation next year to try to do something that goes across the board with everything, including entitlements and taxes and discretionary spending. So it's hard to say just how this is going to sort out, but I think it's the one thing we know is that it's going to be challenging. I think if we can hang on to the money that we have in the current baseline, we're going to be lucky, and that might be that probably is the high water mark, and it could be less than that. And so that's one of the reasons we're starting early to have this discussion ahead of time. So if we get into that kind of situation, we've got we've had some thought put into it about where we move going forward.
What were some of the most surprising things you heard in the field hearings in Iowa, Idaho, California, and Wyoming? I don't know whether they dealt with National Animal ID or the ACRE program. What did you hear that you didn't expect to hear?
I guess I hear it all. I have everybody come through my office here in Washington, you know, and so I probably am not the right one to ask that question because I probably hear it all ahead of time. But I guess in Wyoming, we focused on the forest issues. I guess I didn't realize quite what a mess this Forest Service approach to things are and just how this has gotten out of control. And I don't know exactly what we do about it, but I was not aware that in that area there in the Colorado, Wyoming, Montana, so forth, they're losing 1,000 trees a day that are falling over, and it's a huge problem what's going on out there.
Can you talk to me a bit about the prospects for crop insurance programs, direct payments, and the ACRE program?
Well, you know, we put the ACRE program together. We didn't have a huge sign-up nationwide, but, you know, there's pockets where there was a fairly good sign-up. I had one county in my district where we had 80% of the producers signed up in one county in my district. You know, it's a little bit early to be able to tell just exactly how that worked, although what's kind of surprising, it looks like wheat probably came out the best, which wheat was not a big fan of this, but it looks like the wheat producers probably came out the best, the ones that used the ACRE program. But we had some discussions out in the road about, you know, the program was too complicated. I think it had some inherent flaws. The statewide trigger, I don't think it's workable. I think we're going to have to go to a county-by-county trigger if we move ahead with the revenue program. We have to make it simpler, and we have to coordinate all this more with crop insurance, not only the ACRE program but also the SURE program. And one of the things we're looking at is, can we do a better coordination between crop insurance, revenue, and SURE? And that question kind of ties into what's going on with the SRA right now, and there's we heard a fair amount of concern about that from people out there, concerned, you know, if these big cuts are negotiated, whether we're going to lose that out of the baseline, will that tie our hands going forward as we try to write a new bill, and is there a way that we, if we're going to make changes in the crop insurance program, is there a way that we can keep that money in the baseline to try to do this effort to get a better coordination between these programs and therefore a better safety net.
We're talking this afternoon with Congressman Colin Peterson. He is the chair of the Agricultural Committee in the House of Representatives and hails from Minnesota. More with him in a moment here on The Farming World.
It's National Mocha Tort Day. On this day in agricultural history, in 1838, Thomas Andrew Knight died. a British horticulturalist and botanist, he initiated the field of fruit breeding, and he studied the effects of pollen in the garden pea on seed characteristics. He also investigated controlled environmental culture, better known as greenhouses, as well as plant nutrition, fertilization, and pest control. In 1886, W. Marshall patented a grain binder. In 1934, a two-day Dust Bowl storm caused major ecological and agricultural damage to the American and Canadian prairies. The phenomenon was caused by severe drought, coupled with decades of extensive farming without crop rotation or other techniques to prevent erosion. In the 1930s, millions of acres of farmland became useless for planting. The Dust Bowl was centered on the panhandles of Texas and Oklahoma, as well as parts of New Mexico, Colorado, and Kansas. And in 1946, B.F. Goodrich announced the development of the tubeless tire. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Listening to The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Our guest today is the chair of the House Agriculture Committee, Colin Peterson, from the 7th District in Minnesota. Mr. Peterson, when we last spoke, we were talking about possible coordination between some of the programs, crop insurance and ACRE in particular. Were there ideas that were bantered around while you were on the road?
I think we heard some concern that I have, I've expressed myself about whether the current safety net is adequate when we get into a bad situation. And we continue to, in spite of the fact that we say we're never going to have another ad hoc disaster program, and, you know, we put a permanent disaster sure program in the last farm bill. And now we have another ad hoc disaster that's been added to the appropriation bill over in the Senate that appears may end up being passed this year. So clearly the system is not taking care of the situation, that arise. And one of the other issues is that we don't cover all of the agriculture crops. We're making progress on that, but there's people out there that think that we need to have crop insurance that covers all of the farm crops, not only crops that grow, but also livestock. You know, it's if the loan rates and target prices, we had some testimony that people wanted to raise those because clearly they're inadequate, and if we get down to those levels, we're in big trouble. But, you know, I told them there isn't going to be money to raise those. That's not a realistic option. So that's one of the reasons we're looking more at revenue.
Well, how do you make ACRE and crop insurance work better together?
Well, the crop insurance system has, at least in my part of the world, and I think has moved to a kind of revenue coverage. You know, that's the primary policy that's out there now, which is similar to what we're doing with the revenue program. And, we want to make sure we're not duplicating things there. If there's a way to use the revenue program to enhance crop insurance, I think I've told people the way this is going and the way that people are putting pressure on farm programs, you know, I think somewhere down the line, 20 years from now, we may end up with crop insurance as the only safety net we have in agriculture, and maybe the revenue program is a transition to that as we move ahead.
Earlier in the year on crop insurance, they had taken up What, for all intents and purposes, I suppose, is the premium that the companies that sell the crop insurance for the United States and the Department of Agriculture happen to get once they make those sales, and trying to put that at a level that was respectable enough for them to decide to make sure that they went out and sold the insurance, but not so much that it seemed like a problem within the budget. Did they come to any? Did they come to an adequate something that was adequate in the end? Where do we finish up on that one?
That's a very complicated question. You know, there's a bunch of things going on here. For one thing, in 07-08, because the prices went up so much, we had to have a reimbursement system to the agents and the companies that is based on a percentage of policies. So in my part of the world, you know, policies went up two or three times for the same coverage. And so the reimbursements went up two or three times to the agents and the companies. That probably created somewhat of an overpayment in those years. But, you know, you can't necessarily gauge everything on those 2 years because they were somewhat of an anomaly. So that's one thing. The second thing is we have this percentage A&O that we do, and it includes the company underwriting gains and the agent commissions. And you get the two of them mixed up, and it's hard to tell what the heck's going on, you know, what's going to the commissions, what's going to the agents, what's going to the companies. That's going to take a legislative change. I tried to do that in the Farm Bill, wasn't able to, but so that's an issue out there. And then you've got the big I states, or the, you know, the I states versus the rest of the country, where in Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, it's less risk to the companies to write insurance in those areas than it is in other parts of the country because of the way the system works. The agents really control the business, not the companies. And so the agents that write in those states that have less exposure and therefore more profitability for the companies, the companies are paying those agents a lot more than they're paying agents in, say, North Dakota or Texas. And so that's one thing they're trying to do in the SRA is to delineate between these states in terms of what the A&O is, and that is... created somewhat of a ruckus out there because obviously nobody wants to take less than what they're currently getting. So these are all the issues that are in play here. Some of the things that I mentioned can be dealt with by the department with their authority that they have now. Some of the things have to be done legislatively, and that's part of what we're going to continue to look at as we move to the next Farm Bill, no matter what happens in the outcome of this SRA.
Congressman, we appreciate you taking the time with us today, and hopefully we can talk with you again in the future.
I hope to do that. Thank you very much.
Congressman Colin Peterson from the 7th District in Minnesota, also the chair of the House Committee on Agriculture. You've been listening to The Farming World. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.